On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment.
Check.
It's one, The Treatment. Three. The person checking the mic across from me is the star, director, and co-writer of Miles Ahead. He's been here on any number of occasions, of course, for his TV series on Showtime, House of Lies. But he is Don Cheadle, and the story is the story of a day in the life of Miles Davis. I'll be very specific about this so people don't go thinking, wait, why wasn't he in this fight? He's only 15 years old in St. Louis. It's a lot of material to boil down, but it's a really fascinating film, and Don Cheadle's here to talk about it. First of all, thanks so much for coming to talk about the film.
Thank you for having me, Elvis.
And thanks for the sort of KCRW shout-out in the film, WCRK.
There you go.
We'll take it where we can get it. But yeah. I've been talking to you about this movie for a while now. Mm-hmm. And every time I talk to you, it's been like this kind of series of diminutions. With stuff being this,
yep.
I've got my hands pretty widespread. And it still covers a lot of material, but you had to shave the budget down any number of times, didn't you?
Yeah, every time that there was sort of a dance with a potential financier and they'd say, oh, wow, this is great. I mean, everybody responded to the script, dug the script, liked how it was constructed, understood the dynamics that we were trying to do. And they said, but it's just a little too big, you know, get it down a couple million, we're in business. And we'd return to the script, Stephen Begelman and myself, my co-writer, and we'd, you know, just get it tighter and leaner. And we actually, every time we cut it, we kind of liked it. And we'd bring it back and they'd go, wow, you did it. That's great. Pass. So, and that happened, I don't know, four or five times. It was just a constant, you know, uphill battle. And at one point, really, I mean, we wrote two other scripts during this period of time, sold another show, did, you know, we were really, always came back to it. And it was the one that we really, really loved. But just constantly running into that kind of roadblock. At one point, I thought, well, maybe it's me. Maybe they're very uncomfortable with me being a first-time director, and this material is kind of challenging, and they're not sure, and that's okay, I get that. Let's get another director in who has a track record and somebody that they can hopefully have some confidence in and start writing a check. And I went to a few guys, and you know, we did that dance with them for a minute, and they all ultimately turned around and were like, you know, this is yours. Why I'm not? This is yours. Why would I direct this? You direct your own thing. That's, you're all over it. You got to do it. And I'm like, because we can't get a green light, you know? So I'm just trying to get green. And eventually I took it back on and did it.
Yeah, you said that the other night when we were doing the Q&A, because it just feels it's this kind of thing that's in your blood, because so much of what you do as an actor, and we've talked about this here before, is physical. And so much of Miles was about a physical presence, about a physical mystique, he wanted to create.
Yeah.
And I feel like he must have almost got that first.
Well, it was definitely a part of it. You know, it's something that I've been looking at Miles and Miles tapes from, you know, every sort of iteration of who he was and every new, you know, kind of style that he put on, a new car he had or new way that he approached his new hair. Like every time Miles was new, every time you saw him.
Or the blue contact lenses.
Whatever he was doing, it was always some new thing about how to express himself. And then when the paintings, I was like, oh my God, the dude's a painter too and a really good one. So I've been looking at Miles for a long, 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 long time. So I guess there was something that was in there, you know, already. But I was...
But did you like the physical thing of him? That kind of, that swagger that basically dared you to talk to him? Because you got that pretty fast, obviously.
Well, yeah. I mean, I feel, I really understand it. I feel like there's something about that, in talking to his family about it, that there's also a lot about that swagger that is about protection and trying to guard that soft place in the middle of you that you create from that people want to get at and want to know what it's about and poke at it and want to pull at it. And he just created this sort of like stay off of me thing, a lot of it was who he was, but also a lot of that was about trying to protect that place that he created from and keep it for himself and not give it away.
Yeah, I mean, because so much of this character, I mean, is there's a kind of an arrogance that masks that insecurity, mm-hmm. That so many people don't even associate with Miles Davis.
Well, yeah, they think he's not a human. And in some ways, they think, you know, it's all cool and it's all just this exterior, this roughness. But when you think about it, the hardest people that we know, like the coolest people that we know, are sometimes the scaredest people that we know, and sometimes the most cautious people that we know and afraid of being hurt. You know, that's not an excuse for his behavior or anything like that, but it's definitely, I understand it. And, you know, when you read the research and come up against stories like Miles thinking about, is it cooler to tap my whole foot to keep time or just tap my foot inside my shoe? Now, that belies the coolest person in the world. The coolest person in the world isn't wondering who's looking at his foot. You know, so that to me, when you find nuggets like that, you're like, yeah, of course this person is, there's much more to it than that facade would seem to represent.
But there's so much self-awareness in him and the idea of playing that and sort of personifying that must have been kind of scary to you.
Well, I mean, it's always in a way, I mean, except for all the pressure that, you know, that came with the taking on all of the roles. That's what we love to do as actors, you know. It's actually some of our most fun and rewarding and expressive and safe place to be is when you get to inhabit these characters that are, you know, fully three-dimensional and have a lot going on. You get to, you know, kind of try to pour yourself into them and find the places that you guys connect. And as you're, and this maybe just sounds like a bunch of esoteric BS, but it's part of it is that, you know, that really nebulous thing where you're reaching out to try to find where you and that character meet.
Esoteric BS was almost the original name of the show. It's The Treatment. My guest is Don Cheadle. He's starring in a film he directed. His directorial debut is Miles Davis in the film Miles Ahead. It's also the new season of House of Lies on Showtime. But one of the things I talked to you about the other night, I was fortunate enough to moderate a Q&A with you and two of your co-stars.
And it was great. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. It's that it's a movie that's really full of ideas. And I know you as a guy who talks ideas all the time and somehow has to subtly, we're not so subtly, get these ideas in the movie. So There are a couple of scenes that I told you I thought really sort of show me who you were as both as a writer and a director. I want to talk about them here for people to hear because I don't want to give too much of the movie away because it's really an impressionistic piece that's literally about 10 different movies. Mm-hmm. But it holds together in this kind of emotional through line, which I said the other night. There's an emotional truth to it. And it's almost like it's Scheherazade telling stories to keep himself from being bored. Mm-hmm. But the two great moments for me are there's a moment where he gets in a fight with a journalist played by Ewan McGregor who locks him out of his house. And that for me was the metaphor of the movie. I mean, that story you're trying to tell. We should say the movie takes place during that 5-year interregnum when Miles didn't record and there were all kinds of rumors that he had died and all kinds of things that happened. And he went from being incredibly public to just disappearing from the public eye.
Yeah, the Howard Hughes of jazz, they were saying.
Yeah, absolutely. And that scene is, I think, a really remarkable piece of work.
You're right. You landed on what we were, the purpose of that beat. Was to physicalize, as you know, you talked about, demonstrably this being pushed out of your own, you know, your own claim to who you are. He was, you know, in that moment we were going to, if we had the set to deal with it and we had the location that would have allowed us to do it, I wanted to jump way across the street and shoot from the top of a building and just have Miles be very, very small in the frame and just dwarfed by sound, by passersby, you know, this idea that you can be this incredibly prolific and important figure and have such an impact on your art form, your world. And then because you've given it away or let it slip out of your fingers or this mercurial thing that is hard to hold on to, and then you can just be someone that's pushed out and everyone gets to define you. You no longer define yourself. You're just this small thing. Even though you were Miles Davis, now you're just someone who's locked out of his house with a bad hip.
By a white dude.
You cannot get back in. And oh well.
And the great thing about that is that you play that scene for comedy. You're not hitting people over the head with it at all. I mean, it's really kind of a throwaway thing that is a great piece of staging. And if you're paying attention, you know the Miles story, it's really, you kind of, the laughter chokes in your throat as you're watching it.
Yeah, we tried to put a lot of things like that in there where, as you said, not to step on them too hard, but yes, if you're watching, if you're paying attention, what is happening is what continues to happen throughout that film. And it happens from the first 2 minutes in the film when the reporter is trying to tell him how he's going to frame his story and say, this is what I'm going to say. And Miles says, nah, I'm going to say how I tell my story. And it's going to be a song. So just sit back and listen to it.
You're talking about that sort of sentimental streak in him. And you actually use that in visual terms because the album cover we see the most in the movie is Someday My Prince Will Come with mm-hmm. his beautiful wife, Frances, played by Emma Yahtzee.
Cornelia.
In the film. I mean, that's another visual sort of motif he uses sort of offer us who he really was. But that song, I mean, just using that
absolutely
that song is, a lot of people forget that Miles Davis did that song. It wasn't just Big Fun and
right.
Sorcerer.
Right, right. I mean, and that's also been a very interesting thing is to bump into people who have their different points of contact with Miles Davis and when they first discovered Miles Davis. And, you know, a lot of guys that I've talked to who were in a rock thing in a rock bag didn't know anything about Miles before Bitches Brew. They had no interest in him and they didn't like jazz or anything, but they loved this. A lot of acid rock dudes love Miles Davis because of that period. And then I've talked to people who much later than that only knew Miles through like Tutu and the Warner Brothers stuff and Amandala and things like that. And then, you know, then people who only knew that he did the Skritti Politti cover and Cyndi Lauper and Human Nature and, you know, like what, that dude did other stuff? It's like, yeah, that dude did a lot of other stuff. But so, you know, for me, it's always great because people get to have their end point whenever it is and then can often move in either direction and bump into a bunch of other great, you know, music that this man put on the planet for us.
But you must have found one of the ways you connected with him is that he clearly had a fast-moving, easily bored mind.
That's right.
And you must have just felt this, in some ways, that was perfect for you because I know you as that kind of guy.
Well, what it did for me in the film was, you know, matched up very well with the sort of tempo rhythm that I had as the writer, director, producer, you know, everything was at a high rate of intensity and it was constantly moving. And it's things that we actually thought about, Stephen Bagel and myself thought about when we were writing the script, is that we wanted it to be structured in such a way that I, functionally having to exercise all of these, you know, different jobs, could do it and stay in my character as much as I could, that I could have that sort of up-tempo, frenetic restlessness, and it would feed itself into the script and into the production and into what we were trying to do, into the whole process. So we wanted to be meta about the whole thing from soup to nuts, all of it.
But it also helps, too, if you're setting in a period where he's not recording, so you don't have to stick to any one style of music, doesn't it?
Yeah, I wanted to definitely have the opportunity to use all of that music because I'm not a fan of everything, but I'm a fan of parts of all of it. And I wanted to introduce all of that and have all of that be in there and have people hear, you know, a song like Go Ahead, John, which is just John McLaughlin solo over this drum set and go, that's Miles? It's like, all of this is Miles, you know? And when you listen to his music, it's just so cinematic. And there are songs that, as we, you know, I think demonstrate in the movie, that you just can put right into the film and, you know, then it feels like it was scored for that scene. So we wanted to have the music be as much of a driver as any sort of plot that we came up with.
But an album like Bitches Brew really is like a movie that he basically, you can edit four or five different versions and you hear the unexpurgated Bitches Brew, which is like 4 hours.
Yeah.
And it's all over the place. You get to hear what the editing process was like for him.
Well, I think it's amazing. And you know, they were doing, making loops then, you know, really earlier than that, Tio and he were doing things that, you know, hip hop does now. They were doing it in 1958, 1960. And to hear that album is really to experience, I think, Miles Davis, because it feels to me like it's falling apart. At the same time, it's coming together and you get to be a part of this process and they're showing you all of it. And it's, in some ways, to me, like the highest respect that an artist can pay to his audience, which is to say, here, look, come in. We're going to show you, get to sit in the room and hear how we work something out.
Because I feel like Bitches Brew for me in this weird way reflects what the movie is, because so much about showing those rough spots and those corners in the life. You know, this is about, listen, either you respond to, you got to respond to this first and foremost emotionally.
That's right.
And that's what you wanted the movie to be, wasn't it?
Yeah. And really feel like a composition and really feel like an expression and my expression of my experience of Miles Davis music. You know, it's like, I said this before, but it's like Don Cheadle is Miles Davis as Miles Davis in Miles Ahead. That's how we used to talk about it, that we are completely aware that we are taking this artist's life and saying we're going to approach it as he would approach his medium. That's how we want to approach our medium. More that we are taking instructions from Miles Davis about how to be creative and how to approach your work, as opposed to giving instructions about Miles Davis and what he did, you know, chronologically in some way that feels like we're just trying to allow you to cram for a test, for you to, you know, get your pop quiz on when you leave.
Well, we're going to take a break and let you get your pop quiz on. My guest is Don Cheadle. His new film is co-writer, director, star, everything you want to name, including performer as a musician, is the film Miles Ahead. It's a treat, but there's more to come. Stay with us.
Check out KCRW's music blog for song premieres, music news, performances, and KCRW DJ features. You can keep up to date on all of KCRW's music happenings at kcrw.com/musicblog.
Welcome back. There's way too much to talk about with my guest, our old friend Don Cheadle. It's the 20th year of the show, and it's always good to have an old friend back. He's back with new wine in a very new bottle. The movie is Miles Ahead, in which he plays Miles Davis, which he co-wrote, which he stars, which he directs, which he plays in. And one of the things I want to talk to you about, too, is there's so much to talk about, but like Miles, you it's not just a solo. You give the other people in the ensemble a chance to play, be it Ewan McGregor or Miyazi or Michael Stuhlbarg. I mean, it really was that sense, too. At a certain point, you just sort of step back and let other people have the movie.
Well, it was really written. Like, I mean, we wrote the scene where Dave has to go, you know, play his solo and get Miles what he said he's going to get him and let's go.
Now, this is the character played by Ewan McGregor.
Yeah, Ewan McGregor, Dave Braden, this Rolling Stone, so to speak, reporter who's burst into Miles' life under the auspices of getting this comeback story.
And that's a big deal because the idea of a jazz guy in Rolling Stone would have been a huge deal. And still to this very day.
Yeah, for sure. And so that the scene that we wrote where Dave has to perform, was we actually wrote it in that way that you're speaking about it in the script. You know, it says Miles steps back and lets Dave step up and play his solo, and he better kill it. You know, it's like, you better play the solo right. But yeah, absolutely. To me, that's the most, I have the most fun, and I think it's the most rewarding experience for everybody when the ensemble has the same import and the same ability to play and be expressive as the quote-unquote lead has. And talk about House of Lies, you know, the pilot episode, we have this closing scene where I'm supposed to go in and just close this banker who we're trying to make this deal with. And when I first saw the script, it was a 2.5-page monologue of Marty just, you know, putting this guy in the spin cycle and working his brain and boom, closing him. And I'm like, well, why is my team here? You know, if I'm the only one doing this, why are they don't need to sit here. Why are they in here? I said, I think that we should actually start getting this guy, you know, ping-ponging him. And it's like, I feel like that's how we should work. We should all work this dude. And everyone needs to be a part of that process. And everyone, when they can have a voice and have a place in the song, I think the song is just better.
It's so much to talk about here because one of the things I always find myself thinking about, and I never actually mentioned this to you before, but you work best when you create a personal dynamic with your character, be it Miles or Marty or House of Lies or any number of people, doesn't necessarily like the people he works with, but knows how to get the best out of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I guess that's a part of it too. And I think in some ways, again, meta Miles, you know, he would pick people often that the people in his band sometimes didn't really vibe and there was issues and how's this going to work. But he didn't care about any of that. he tells this story about Herbie that I love, and it's just his humor on display. It's like, you know, Herbie's got all this facility and can play all this stuff, but, you know, he really, really, really can be disciplined and structured. He goes, and then we go over to Europe, and, you know, Herbie sits down at the piano, and Miles does this gesture of, like, throwing his coattails over the bench and starts playing all this classical. He's like, what are we doing? And it's just his humor. It's just so funny to me, the things that he picks up on, the ways that he expresses it. You know, he's just very smart and funny.
The thing that he and to some extent, Marty have in common, they know how to read people and actually push the soft spots.
Yeah.
And make them bark.
And protect their own.
Yes.
Hopefully keep their own behind the nice, you know, embankment while everyone else is out there dealing with it.
But to having these two guys whose lives dovetail in some ways, but still very different people, it must have been a really interesting period for you, because, again, throughout all the time the House of Lies has been on, you've been working to get this movie going.
Yeah, all of those things were happening, and I was in a metal suit flying around. I mean, I had to leave 3 weeks during pre-production on a six-week pre-production schedule to go shoot Avengers 2 for 3 weeks. And that was like, man, I mean, you know, this is just what this whole ride is going to be like. It's just not going to be easy. It's never going to be cush. We're just going to have to deal with everything that we're going to have to deal with. But in many ways, again, it felt like that's what it required, and that's what he was always able to do. And he would sort of put himself in those positions where he would use disparate players and different disciplines and different ways into something and make it a mess first. And then figure out how to, out of the mess, turn that into some gold. And it's like, wow, that kind of alchemy is like, that's just amazing to me.
Basically went from Charlie Parker to You Build It to John McLaughlin, and actually had Sting come in and do like one line of the song, and apparently scare Sting to death when he came in. I guess it's Don Cheadle, his new film as writer, director, star, producer, everything is miles ahead. One of the things that's interesting too, I want to get back to what we were talking about a little bit in the first half, is one of the other scenes that I think really proves that your mettle as a director, and that's the scene where there's a huge fight between Miles and his wife, Frances. Mm. And I don't want to give too much away because I want people to see the movie, but we'll talk about another scene that to me is also the Maltese Falcon scene at the end of the movie.
Yeah.
That's why I'm saying the movie is so many different movies.
Yeah.
And there's such a sense of playfulness in this, because that thing you're talking about, it's almost a fear of, it's going to be a movie by a black filmmaker about an important subject.
Well, that was my approach. That's why I didn't want to do it. I wasn't interested in doing another biopic, you know. And I was getting, for a while after I had done, I won the Golden Globe for Sammy. That was fantastic. The Oscar nomination for Hotel Rwanda is like wonderful. But then everything that was coming over the transom is like, can you be our black guy in this? You know, can you be the first one? We started calling him, what did your granddaddy do movies? You know, everyone was like the first black man who I'm like, I don't want to do that, you know? So when the idea of this came up, I just wasn't into it, because I had the same reaction. Like, I don't want to do anything that has the I word in front of it. I don't want to do something important. You know, I want to do something that's engaging and hot and feels nuts and really different. I don't want to keep doing those same things again, especially because we know from the first frame where we're headed. And I felt like, especially with Miles Davis, to do that would just be an affront. So I'm very, very glad that the family, you know, understood and got on board and was totally behind the idea that what we should do is something that feels like Miles Davis, as opposed to being something that is the cliff notes of his life. And it really helped to keep coming up against 1,000 no's and being forced to go back and rethink exactly what is needed and what is necessary and what you can do without.
You said the other night, you were kind of shocked when I asked you if Junior was supposed to be this younger manifestation of Miles, because it seemed kind of evident, pretty obvious to me, especially seeing that room and he's a junkie, which he was that age, mm-hmm. and all those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a movie that if people know what they're seeing, then that deepens the enjoyment for them.
Correct.
But it also has clearly, for you, had to function as a movie that was first and foremost an entertainment.
And for people that...
who don't know Miles Davis.
That was it. That was, to me, that was our marching orders, first and foremost, to not try to do something that was so inside that only people who knew the life and the history could attach. I wanted everyone to be able to come in and be engaged. And yeah, there's a lot of Where's Waldo in the movie for people who do know a lot about Miles and do understand all that, including the songs that we used. You know, the first song that we use for MacArthur is Prelude. You know, the first song when he pushes through the elevator in is Miles Ahead. You know, it's all of the songs were also keys to what it was that we were trying to accomplish in the film and the ways that we were trying to keep, you know, echoing and quoting like jazz music does, these quotes that, you know, in other art forms, it would be a ripoff. You know, if you did it, they say, oh, you're ripping it off. But in jazz, you can play Someday My Prince Will Come in the middle of a solo. And people are like, oh, you're just quoting that. You're bringing that thing forward.
It's what the French call homage and we call actionable.
That's
here in
right.
the United States. But I have to ask you this because I do wonder, what was it like the first day on the floor directing your first film?
It was really scary. It was an exterior. So, yeah, just start right off on something difficult. Exterior. Cars, it's the pulling up to Columbia.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, with Dave. We had, you know, buses and cars and a corner that we thought we had control of. Then we show up on the day, they're like, no, you can't actually control that street corner. It's like, oh, okay, so we have to make sure that we control the frame. You know, crowd not locked up. Oh, we didn't know that you were going to have, you needed crowd control. It's like, well, that'd be cool if we could not have people that aren't in the movie walking through the set. That would be cool. So it was just day one. Was just really a trial by fire, and it, you know, it never got a lot simpler than that. It was always very, very tricky. It's a new city. They were very great to us, Cincinnati. They really opened their arms and made every sort of you know, effort to aid and assist us. But they're a new city to this. There wasn't a lot of redundancy in every department. So it was all hands on deck. People were doing things that they had not done before and were, you know, trying to accomplish things that were really new to them. So we had to be nimble and call audibles and, you know, be able to roll with it. But again, everything that we did to me felt like that's what Miles has to do. That's what Miles would have to do. That he would be in the same mindset right now. And I would just always try to hear him saying, you know, play what's not there, you know, jump off a ledge, be wrong, strong, you know, put yourself in a place where you're uncomfortable and afraid. And if you're doing all that, you're doing the right thing. I'm like, okay, well then we must be in the right place.
And what was that first screening like at the New York Film Festival?
Amazing. I was upstairs in the sort of lobby waiting area before we went down, and I was really, really, really nervous and not feeling comfortable at all, and wasn't feeling like Miles Davis at that point. I was feeling like scared ass Don Cheadle. And my daughter saw it all on me, and she's like, you know, Dad, are you all right? I was like, oh, not really. She's like, you're here. You did it. It's done. You should just be happy. And I'm like, yeah, I'm working on it. And she said, Dad, I remember being 9 years old, sitting on your lap as you wrote this thing. And driving in the car and you playing all of this music, and you've just been living with it so long, and now you're going to show it to people and it's out, and it's such a huge accomplishment. You should just, you know, be happy about that part of it. And I was like, wow, okay. My kid, you know, got my head right before I walked into the theater. You know, thank you.
What a time. You know, it's always fun to have you here, Don. Anytime you're coming back, you're always welcome.
Thank you, man.
My pleasure. The movie is Miles Ahead. It's star, co-writer, director,
okay,
producer. Enough. We're out of time. Like, can't think for everything. Don Cheadle. He's also starring in the new season of House of Lies on Showtime. You can come back and talk about that at some point, I guess, and being in Havana and smoking cigars. Well, not smoking cigars. I don't want to get you in trouble with your kids.
Yeah.
So thank NPR West. The show is mixed by Kat Yoris, edited by Blake Veit, who's the associate producer. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's a treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica. Da-da-dee, dee, 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 dee,